Welcome to the Everything EC podcast. I'm your host, Carla Ward, and joining me today is Noni Lasseau, co-director of the Saul Zanz Early Education Initiative at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Today, she is sharing some of the amazing work she and her team is doing to support the early childhood education system. They've recently released a very cool tool that I am so excited for you to learn about and apply to early childhood education in your area. So let's not delay any longer and learn how we can stabilize the system. Welcome to the show, Noni. I am so excited to have you on today.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So we were just talking off screen and we have quite a few lines of connection, but can you tell our listeners who you are and a bit about your initiative that you are working on called the Saul Zanz Early Education Initiative at Harvard?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks again for the invite. So I'm Noni Lasseau. I'm a faculty member at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I've actually been there now 20 years, and it's been fabulous. In 2016, Stephanie Jones, a colleague and other faculty member at the Ed School, and I launched the Saul Zanz Early Education Initiative with the privilege of a very large gift from the Saul Zanz Charitable Foundation. We designed an initiative that would effectively focus on different areas of early education all at once. We have an arm that is a groundbreaking study of early learning and development that has been going since 2018. Started with a statewide sample of 3- and 4-year-olds and looked at all of their early education and care experiences as well as their schooling. And that study continues. The second arm of the initiative is a professional learning academy for leaders to receive early education, to partner with us on their problems of policy and practice. When we launched the Zanz initiative, we noticed that lots of other areas of education have executive education, but not early education. And so this was a chance for us to design a subsidized approach, one that would be both affordable and accessible. We have an online certificate in early education leadership that has enrolled. We have 12,000 enrollments at this point across 90 countries. Our goal was to bring leaders together to surface their problems of practice and policy and to build a network and exchange core knowledge and learn together. The third arm of the initiative is one focused on developing leaders. We have a fellowship program for students doing a master's in education and who have interest in early education, but we enroll from across our programs, from human development to policy to learning design. And so we build a really diverse cohort every year of master students on a fellowship. And then finally, the fourth arm sort of came to us a couple years into the initiative based on our findings and our work, more of a policy arm to take the findings from our study and the work with our leaders to drive into more work with policymakers with data. We've launched a digital tool, the Navigator, very recently, that sort of provides some information exchange and data sharing across states and cities around their early ed system. And we also have a partnership with the Hunt Institute in the South to enroll cohorts of state leaders in an online policy academy. So four pieces, a lot of fun, real privilege. It's been going since 2016.
That is incredible. And one question just immediately came to mind because you just said to enroll state policymakers. How do you get them to enroll?
You know, early ed is a topic that is near and dear to so many policymakers' hearts, right? It's sometimes a personal issue. It might be an issue in their constituency, but also it's very appealing from a policymaking standpoint on its face, right? Which is invest in the next generation, right? Invest in the next generation and you have a workforce development strategy, which is that people can't work if they don't have childcare. So I think there's a bunch of ways in. And I think while it's not where we'd like it to be from an investment perspective, I still think it's a very popular issue. And so when we developed this online academy, we actually didn't have trouble enrolling cohorts who were interested in the science of early learning, in the financing strategies, in the workforce development. But, you know, I'm not suggesting that always converts to big investments, right? As you and I know.
But I love that. And maybe I've become a pessimist, honestly. Like maybe I need, you know, put my optimistic hat on, because I feel like we keep being met with, right, like you're saying, like we're not necessarily seeing the changes, but I'm so glad to hear that you are finding people listening. Like that's half the battle, is just getting people to listen.
Yeah, I think if I stepped back, I would say, you know, I think you can choose the optimism or the pessimism, and I think you can make the case either way. But I do want to say that over the last few years, I do think there's been a real thrust. And, you know, COVID kind of brought childcare into the everyday lives of everyone, right? It's in some way, shape, or form. Like it became clear we rely on childcare and schools to work, right? And that just became so much more a reality for everybody, not just kids, not just families with young kids. But the other thing I'll say is, you know, we've been here in the US, we've been sort of circling around and dancing around, like we're so on the brink of big investments. And that's a for better and a for worse kind of story. But I think we can focus on the for better, which is I do think we're getting closer and closer in certain ways to more of a systems level strategy. But we're not there. I'm not going to suggest we're there.
No, but at least we are on the train tracks heading exactly. towards a destination, which I have to say is so great to hear, because sometimes I think, you know, maybe I'm so pessimistic, I don't even see the train through the fog.
Well, I do think one change over the last few years that I've certainly noticed in part as somebody who got involved in state policymaking, but even just tracking this field over the last 7 or 8 years, I do think one major shift here in the US is that we have gotten away from just the straight up case making and the advocacy to more sort of informed guidance, plans, prescriptions. So I think that kind of shift in the rhetoric and the advocacy from something more case making to something more specific and data driven has started to be a little more the norm, which I think is also an indicator that we're headed in the right direction.
And I love that. And so I just had this conversation with somebody about how when we start looking at early childhood education with a business hat on versus a babysitting hat, which unfortunately is a stigma we still fight on occasion, I would like to say less than we used to 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when we look at it as a business, it's much easier to make your case.
Economic infrastructure, right? I mean, so I am personally sometimes a little disappointed that we have to do that, right? That it can't be about early ed for the next generation and early ed for kids and families. But you're right. Like we should argue it however we need to argue it to reach the folks who make decisions. And one of those arguments that's very compelling is that it is economic infrastructure. If you don't have a strong early education and care system, people can't go to work.
And that's exactly what I was speaking to somebody out in Montana whose childcare center is attached to a hospital. They have hundreds of jobs available at this hospital that they cannot fill because they do not have the childcare space.
And part of it's the space, but also those workers can't afford what's out there privately, right? So often the mid-range healthcare career, which is not a doctor or even a nurse, right? It's below that as far as salary. The private market is out of reach. It's going to be a wash at best. Right. Oh,
absolutely. And so let's dive into more of the gravity of the childcare crisis and its potential, like the long-term effects that we could see if we don't pull it together soon.
Well, I do think, I mean, you know, there's been this sort of heightened attention, more exposure over the last several years, partly in large part due to COVID. And then in here in the US, the COVID dollars also showed us what we can do if we make big investments, right? So again, we're sort of in this double-edged sword. Like we learned what we could do and we innovated in certain ways in states and cities, and it showed us how you might stabilize a system. I think the big picture, like for me, the big worry and the takeaway is that we will be caught in this vicious cycle if we don't, this may be self-evident, but there is a vicious cycle and it will never stop if we don't stop it, right? Yeah. And the vicious cycle is we don't invest in a workforce. So the workforce turns over regularly. We have trouble recruiting and retaining. we know it's a good idea, but we can't, the business model at scale is not viable. So we don't have a stable infrastructure at the level here in the US of cities and states, provinces and cities in Canada. So, you know, effectively what happens is you're putting some public dollars into a private system, but the private system doesn't have enough horsepower to be stable and universal. And so again, I'm sort of back to this cycle. I think if we could turn it on its head and say, okay, cities and states or provinces need to fund the infrastructure such that we are not unlike K-12, we have a like a baseline system, and then we plug dollars into it. Now we're in a different scenario, but I think this idea that we fund slots, but we don't fund a system, it just reproduces the chaos at some level, and we never get to something more stable.
And that is exactly, that sums it up, right? That's the crisis.
Yeah, the crisis is just that we let the market behave how the market's going to behave when something is scarce and unaffordable. And then we say we don't have a system. Well, we wouldn't have a system because we haven't invested in one.
Oh, exactly. Now, is that where the Zants Navigator comes in, or is that something completely different?
Oh, you know, that's really interesting. In some ways, yes. So the Zants Navigator came about in large part because it's actually been very hard to find information over the years about what states and cities systems look like, right? So there are quality rating systems, but they don't first start with just describing systems. And one thing you want often policy makers and partners to states and cities working with them want to do is first just look at other states or cities and see what their system looks and feels like.
Yeah.
We couldn't find anything that just did that kind of mapping and in a kind of user-friendly, universal way, accessible way. And so that's the Navigator. The Navigator basically says in any given state, what are the features in five categories, and who are the families and children being served? What's the geography like, urban, rural, you know, all kinds of things you might want to know in order to inform your own work and planning somewhere else. Similarly, actually, lots of organizations within states and cities don't have a good sense of the overall landscape. It's hard to figure out.
Well, I was just going to say, I was like, unless I do a deep dive and call in favors of people who work at this center or this center, even knowing, you know, how much is your center licensed for? Like, how many toddlers do you have? How many preschoolers do you have? And then, you know, even I would love for you to share a bit more about like the insights of what the Zants tool tells us. But just being able to know that even before you open a childcare center.
That's right.
Right.
Just get a feel for the, like to your point, a feel for the lay of the land. Like what, like what are we talking about? What is the population of young children in this state or city, for example? Right.
Even exactly. Just that,
right. Yeah. So we had the same story to tell, which is, you know, so many people were saying they were making all these phone calls, like money would come in from, especially in COVID, dollars came in quickly. Yep. States had to make decisions, make plans, figure out what lever to pull, what's the best strategy. They're getting on the proverbial telephone, right, to call people in their networks, other states, other cities. And so we just saw this opening and thought, if we could design something that might be useful, then it would be part of our mission to bring more data and information to the space.
I love that. And has it been around long enough for you to start to see a shift in anything?
No, it's a month. It's hot. It's like hot off the press. We launched it about a month ago.
Oh, so it is new.
Yeah, it's new. And we're just working with a group of beta testers who are trying it out with different hats on and lenses, but it's brand new. And the idea was just to see in this first phase uptake, who's interested, who's using it. Like, no, we don't yet have any trends or patterns.
But that's okay, because that just means we're going to have another podcast.
That's right. That's right.
Talk about the findings, because I think I just interviewed somebody from Connecticut and their particular organization pays for housing because they couldn't figure out a way to increase their staff salaries without increasing the fees for parents. So they offset it by funding the housing.
The family childcare house.
Yeah. Yeah. For their staff. So if you were a staff, like if you were a staff member, you had housing. And so innovative ways like that are amazing. But again, unless you get on the phone or listen to a podcast, you don't know it exists.
Exactly. You know, basically the strategy is in one way or another, reduce fixed costs, because monthly costs are untenable. Basically, it's not a viable model month over month, year over year. So any of these strategies are really about reducing the denominator effectively.
Exactly. And it allows people to have control over their time and money, which in early childhood education, the teachers just don't have that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Design and deliver every day. I mean, you can't build the plane and fly it and run a business and balance the books and, no. Right?
And yet they do, right? At the cost of their own mental health.
At scale, exactly. It's not a healthy, viable model. I couldn't agree with you more. Dedicated, resilient, but I really wish we could make it easier for them to do their 100%. Jobs.
Yeah. Well, it's like you're saying, right? We're going around in this circle and, you know, we've got to get off the ride at some point.
Yes, agreed.
Right. So now you're the chair of the board of the
Massachusetts. I was the chair of the board for seven years. But I no longer as of December 2022.
My Googling failed me.
That's
okay. So based on your experience, though, what lessons or strategies do you think people can apply on the broader scale to get us off that ride, to stop, you know, going around in circles?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think our greatest learning in COVID, especially because we had resources to innovate with, was really what I was talking about earlier, which is we derived a formula whereby any licensed childcare organization would receive a baseline monthly payment regardless of the population they served. If they served more vulnerable children, the formula adjusted for that. If they were in a under-resourced area, we adjusted the formula. But the big difference was, this was the first time ever in Massachusetts where we've taken dollars and applied them to the whole system, not just to those serving children and families who qualified for subsidy. So what we said, and this is what I was talking about earlier, is what we said was, okay, just being a childcare operator of some sort, whether it's family-based or center-based, and whether it's serving largely private or public, you are at risk and you are essential to the state. And what we saw was just so, what we heard about and, you know, captured through surveys was just that we were the difference between lots of small entities being able to stay open versus closing their doors. And I think, you know, it was a little controversial in certain ways, because I think there's a sense that those large for-profit networks are super viable. The truth is they're not that viable, and their staff's wages are no better often because of the infrastructure. It's not that somebody's making a whole lot of money at the top. It's that the overall model is not viable. Yeah. It's a very expensive human capital enterprise. If we charged families for K-12 education, we'd be in the same boat. If you look at private school tuitions, it's the same idea. It's all about paying personnel. So we said to the statewide, to the centers, you know, you can tell us what you're going to do with the money, but you can do with it what you will. You could cover operations, you could give bonuses for staff. You probably wouldn't invest in hourly wages because the money may not come back again. And so, but you know, it taught us a lot about this idea that if we would just invest a certain amount statewide in just stabilizing the system and then tweak with the different, you know, tweak on the edges with the kind of population you're serving, or, you know, in a rural isolated area, you may need a different strategy, that kind of thing. But the idea of like funding operations was really new and really effective.
Oh, different, I bet it was.
Different things with the money, because they all are micro they're all micro centers. They're all ecosystems of their own. And so, but it taught us a lot about why if we could get over this hump and have state or federal level investment in just building the system, we could really make a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. And you've nailed it on the head. Stabilizing the system it has to be the first step.
Yeah.
Because,
and that has to be about the workforce largely.
Oh, for sure. Because I mean, I think about building a building, right? You can't build the first floor if your basement's all out of whack.
Yeah. And you know, often when we've given centers money, we're so prescriptive with the dollars and it doesn't actually meet their infrastructure needs, right? And this was a chance to sort of say, okay, you are expert in your own setting and you have your own little micro economy going and business. And what is it that you need to do? And it really played out very differently. Some places, you know, paid offset on rent so they could, you know, I mean, there's just different ways to play around with the idea of infrastructure dollars.
Yeah. And to think that one rule would fit all is naive because every center is so different, serves okay. different economic backgrounds. And so right. I think that's such a great idea to give them the autonomy to spend it how they want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No question. I mean, within reason, we just like we do with K-12, we should be talking about stable funding sources for sure.
Absolutely. Here's your budget. Yeah. These are the, you know, here's the guidelines.
Yeah.
Now, go serve our youngest community, right?
And if you want to raise tuition, it's because you're trying to do something extra or you have a selling point or something like that, but you're not raising tuition on the backs of working families at levels that are unaffordable either.
Yeah, because it becomes that vicious cycle again, where if you raise the rates, families are going to have to pull out. Therefore, you're going to have to let staff go. And therefore, you're no better off than you were keeping it at an affordable cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, it's an interesting profession that we're in right now because it is on the brink of changing. And I think as long as we continue to have conversations about it, we will continue to move forward. But for those of us, you know, don't have amazing boards that are, you know, putting things across the state, what do we ask our policymakers to do? How do we start?
You know, it's a good question and it's a very local question. So I'll take a crack at it, understanding that it is a super local question. But I think that the degree to which, I mean, I think if you can't raise wages, then I don't think anything else really works. In other words, I'm not saying wages equals higher quality, but you can't really work on quality if your wages are so low that your turnover is high and you have trouble recruiting in, right? People are rational actors. They're going to go and work at Walmart where they're going to go and do other things, not because they don't adore the craft and raising the next generation, but because it's not viable. So no. I think if you don't work on wages and trying to make commitments, longer term commitments to raising wages steadily, I think we just won't. I'm not suggesting quality will come void a quality strategy, but trying to work on quality without a stabilizing strategy at the level of the workforce seems to me a totally inefficient model.
Agreed. And there's that word again, stabilizing. And I think that's something we really have to zone in as educators, because there is data that says, you know, when a teacher stays, it serves the children better, right? Totally. High turnover is not beneficial to our youngest learners.
And it's also a real waste. You know, the center director spends a lot of time onboarding, I don't need to tell you, there's all kinds of inefficiency every time somebody leaves the profession.
Exactly.
It's hard on kids, it's hard on colleagues, it's hard on centers, et cetera.
Exactly. Well, Noni, amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise. Where can people dive into the Zants Navigator? Because I think this is a great first step for us to even continue the conversation in our industry.
So it's linked on the Zants Early Education Initiative website. So zants.gse.harvard.edu, and you'll see the Navigator on the homepage.
Awesome. I was playing around with it yesterday and I was like, oh my gosh, we need one of these over here. So who knows, maybe that's my next step.
Yeah.
But amazing. And I will make sure that everything's linked. And anything we didn't cover today?
No, I'm thrilled to meet you and have a chance to chat. And I'd love to connect once we know a little more about how the Navigator's playing out.
I would absolutely love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.